Gospel according to Luke. The parents of Jesus used to go every year to Jerusalem for the feast of Passover. And when Jesus was 12, they went up for the celebration, as was their custom. As they were returning at the end of the feast, the child Jesus remained behind in Jerusalem, unbeknownst to Mary and Joseph. Thinking Jesus was in their caravan, they continued their journey for the day, looking for him among relatives and acquaintances. Not finding Jesus, they returned to Jerusalem in search of him. On the third day, they came upon Jesus in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. All who heard Jesus were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When Mary and Joseph saw Jesus, they were astonished, and Mary said, "Son, why have you done this to us? You see that your father and I have been so worried looking for you." Jesus said to them, "Why are you looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in Abba's house?" But they didn't understand what he told them. Then Jesus went down with them to Nazareth and was obedient to them. Mary stored these things in her heart, and Jesus grew in wisdom, in years, and in favor with God and people alike. The Gospel of Christ. So this is the third day of Christmas. On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. It's a good thing Jonathan's not here. He just loves that, that piece of music. The trouble is, we've been singing this trite little song for so many centuries that many of us have forgotten what on earth anybody's true love would be thinking of giving such crazy gifts to their beloved. We need to dig down deeply into the words and images if we are to uncover the meaning of this particular Christmas rhyme. 'Tis true that there are indeed 12 days of Christmas, because of course there are 12 tribes of Israel, but the 12 drummers drumming, we are told, represent not the 12 tribes of Israel, but rather the 12 articles of the Apostles' Creed. And I'm sure that you'll all be relieved that this is only the third day of Christmas, because it means I'm not going to drag you through all 12 gifts to explain their meanings. Just the 3 days. 3 French hens, anyone? No? What are the 3? Well, that's a good guess. I like that. It's not quite it, but let's go. Faith, hope, and charity. 2 turtle doves. Anybody? The New Testament and the Old Testament, what we now call them the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Testament. A partridge in a pear tree. That's right. Jesus, what's the pear tree?
Cross.
That's what most people think. 'Tisn't a cross. It's actually the tree of life. Remember the tree in the garden? It doesn't say it was an apple tree. In fact, in Jewish folklore, it's a pear tree, right? But it doesn't say, it just says it's a fruit tree, and of that fruit you shall not eat. So that's the partridge in the pear tree. Christ in the tree of life, the tree of knowledge, the tree of wisdom. We humans are very strange creatures, always trying to reveal the meaning of our existence. The gift of consciousness brings with it the knowledge of our mortality and the reality that there's a finite duration to our days. And this sends us scurrying to discover what it's all about. And so we invest a great deal of thought and effort into the process of making meaning out of it all. Some of our deepest questions revolve around our quest to know who or what is responsible for our creation. All over the planet, long before time began, humans have been trying to understand the character of the one who created us. Because after all, it's all about us, right? More importantly, who created me? Because it's all about me, really. We've spent the last few weeks leading up to Christmas eagerly waiting our culture's particular celebration of our deepest held notions about the nature of our Creator, whom we understand as intimately involved in creation. And so during these 12 days of Christmas, we celebrate the presence of our Creator in creation as a creature. While the rest of the world heads out to shopping malls or remains glued to the various sports that are on offer or simply tries to recover from the excess of their Christmas feasting, we here in the church, we turn our attention to searching for a recalcitrant adolescent boy. I can't help wondering what this story is actually doing in the church lectionary on this particular day. Or indeed, what is it doing in the second chapter of Luke at all? New Testament scholar Marcus Borg's words keep running through my head, cautioning me not to try to read this story as history, as if we could determine if the story actually happened, but rather to ask ourselves why the writer of the story wrote this story the way that he wrote it. And what's important about this story, so important that it was preserved for us? What is the anonymous gospel storyteller that we call Luke trying to tell us about who this child Jesus is growing up to be? Well, even a cursory reading of this text has to be more than just a literal reading of this text. Because if we limit the meaning to the literal meaning, it's totally unbelievable, and no truth can be revealed. I mean, really, what parents would leave a crowded city, one that was not their home, and journey a whole day without noticing that their child was missing? Today, they would be charged with child neglect. What 12-year-old from a loving home would calmly detach from his parents, enter the portals of what was probably the most daunting building in the entire city, and be found 3 days later in solemn debate with theologians? Not just any theologians, but the theologians who practiced the art at the very heart of the wisdom tradition. And then what Jewish mama, finding her missing child after 3 days, would simply be astonished? I checked the Greek. That's a good translation of it. She's just astonished. Can you imagine her saying in polite Aramaic, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold your father." My mother would be like, right in there. She wouldn't even be waiting for my dad. It would be like, "I'm coming to get you." Give me a break. This story just doesn't make any sense on a literal level. This story is told in a way that most of our family stories are told, in a way that makes all the characters look better than the events suggest they might be. Or maybe this story was told with tongue firmly planted in cheek, trusting that the listeners will recognize the characters and read between the lines. One thing I'm sure of, the first listeners of this story would have recognized themselves in this story. And so I'm also sure that there has to be more than a literal meaning to it. What is the anonymous gospel storyteller trying to tell us about who Jesus was and is? I suspect that many of us find it easier to cast our eyes toward the heavens when it comes to imagining the truth about Jesus. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Imagining Jesus as some otherworldly character who is of one being with the Father, true God from true God, begotten, not made, may sound more like the Jesus we grew up trying to believe in. We're used to thinking about Jesus as some kind of superhuman, some sort of mythical character who miraculously is the only begotten Son sent to save us all from Satan's power, for we have gone astray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Let's relegate Jesus to the otherworldly realms, because up there or out there, even if we struggle to believe any of it, up there or out there, this super Jesus can be controlled. This super Jesus can be subdued and relegated to rare appearances at Christmas and maybe even Easter, or when we're feeling particularly generous toward our fellow humans, and we want to give peace a chance. Then we can trot out this mythical character, this superhuman Jesus, this otherworldly Jesus, this more than human Jesus. And we don't have to worry about emulating this Jesus. We don't have to seriously try to be like him or to follow him in any serious way, because after all, this otherworldly Jesus is God. And we're not God. So yeah, we'll follow him, but not too closely, lest we end up hoisted on our own petard, hanging on a cross in some God-forsaken circumstances that can certainly be avoided as long as Jesus is kept up there, out there, in the heavens, somewhere else. Joan Chittister tells a story that most of you have heard, but in the spirit of Midrash, putting one story beside another, I'm going to tell it. We can see what we can find out about this story from this story that comes to us from the Sufi masters. It's the story of a particular Sufi master who was found scratching through the sand in the middle of a road. And some folks come along, some pilgrims come along, and they say, "What are you doing?" And the old Sufi looks up and he says, "I'm looking for my treasure. I've lost it." So the pilgrims, they're good people, and they all drop down on their knees in the middle of the road to help him look for his treasure. And they sifted sand, and they dug up under the stones, and they sweat under the heat of the sun until finally, hungry, soaking wet with perspiration and exhausted, one of the travelers asks the old Sufi, "Sufi, are you sure you lost the treasure here?" And the old man says, "Oh, no, I didn't lose my treasure here. I lost it over there, behind those mountains." And the pilgrims look at him and they're exasperated and they say, "Well, if you lost it on the other side of the mountains, why in the name of Allah are you searching for it here?" And the old Sufi master says, "I'm looking for it here because there's more light over here." Now, I suspect that many of us continue scratching through the sands of time simply because we think there's more light back there, or indeed up there, or out there. And we're missing the treasure that is right here, right here. The anonymous gospel storyteller that we call Luke over and over again points here, right here and right now, and continues to describe a vision of Jesus that is all too human for our liking. The gospel storyteller is determined that we see Jesus as flesh and blood, a baby born in the muck and the mire of everyday life. As for the angelic voices, well, every human birth requires angelic voices singing praise to the Creator for such a splendid miracle. We've had grandchildren here, 7 of them. All 7 of them, we were singing angelic choruses, singing glory to God at the birth of every child. Every birth is sacred because no matter how humble it is, it's the birth of a human that we're talking about here. A wonderful, splendid creature. A human being that contains in its person all of the splendor of creation. This baby that is born into the ordinary reality of existence is nothing short of divine. Every baby that is born into the ordinary reality of existence is nothing short of divine. Like every human ever born, this child reflects the glory of its creator and holds within it all the potential of full humanity. We've been so busy looking for the divine super Jesus that we miss the divinity that is revealed in the life of Jesus, the divinity that exists in each and every human being. The anonymous storyteller weaves his gospel around the very human Jesus. Yes, the language may seem a little sanitized or ancient to our modern ears, but in this gospel tale, the mythic language of the storyteller is designed to reveal the reality of divinity in this particular child, so that as the gospel unfolds, we will learn about the divinity that exists in every child. The divinity of Jesus lies in his humanity, just as surely as our divinity lies in our humanity. We can see that divinity in each and every child, and we can embody that divinity. The partridge in a pear tree, the Christ in the tree of life, the tree of wisdom, the tree of knowledge. This is the gift, the treasure that the baby Jesus, the adolescent Jesus, and indeed the fully developed adult, the all too human Jesus reveals this treasure to us. Yes, the tree of life is also known as the tree of wisdom. The wisdom that is revealed to us in the life of Jesus, the reality that we are one with our Creator, in whom we live and move and have our being. This is the treasure that we long for. This oneness with creation. This oneness with the Creator. It's time for us to scratch beyond the places we have always scratched, so that we might continue to reveal the treasures of our humanity, the gifts of faith, hope, and love lie deep within each one of us. For we are fearfully, fearfully, and wonderfully made. That ancient use of the word fearfully translates into our modern ears as the word awesome. We are awesome. We are wonderfully made. We are little Christs, every one of us. Beautiful reflections of the one who made us, with so very much to learn about what it means to be love in the world.